Hi, everyone. This is Dave. Welcome, and thanks for your promptness. I hear from my little informant that there are a whole number of you on the line. I appreciate all of your responses and your emails and especially the answers to the questions. I hope you're beginning to see that I'm addressing some of the questions in the process of what we talk about. For example, what are the steps to help people make a transition successfully through divorce was one question, retirement through another. So part of what you're seeing is there are not lockstep steps to do that kind of change or transition, but there are some principles that we can talk about so you can help someone co-create the kind of steps they need, the kind of transition process that is uniquely suited to them so that you can be a catalyst for their change. May I ask for a mute, please, because there's background noise or noise with the microphone or the headset that is interfering. I'd like to keep it open for discussion. Thanks for doing that until you're ready to talk and then unmute star six again. One of the questions that about specific language to address a client's fear of aging, losing control of their lives, leaving behind what they believe to their best years, Lee asked. One is the principle of resonating with someone's concern or their state of mind to basically say, I understand your concern or I understand you're upset about this. That's often the first step so that we're on the same page. We co-create a common ground together. That can help someone regulate a state of mind to then join together in a mutual exploration and a collaboration. We're going to talk about that much more specifically today. And the topic about how to change mind, brain, and behavior is specifically about helping someone in a practical way to regulate a state of mind to join with you in a mutual collaboration. So I hope I'm addressing the questions that each of you have in the process of what we're doing. Thoughts or responses or questions at this point that any of you have, or just comments you'd like to make about what you've experienced thus far. I'm very eager to hear from you.
I have a question.
Yes,
this is Karen.
Welcome. Hey, go ahead.
I tried to email you a question and it kept coming back, male demon or demon or whatever, and I couldn't get the question through. The email that I'm using is on the paper. I tried both Dave Kruger at Coach Alliance, CoachTrainingAlliance.com. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and remember, let me short-circuit that because there's a best way to do that. It's D. Kruger, D-K-R-U-E-G-E-R, at MentorPath.com.
Uh-huh.
It's the email that I send the various correspondence I do to the group. I put it on blind copy so because I don't have permission to reveal your emails. So I address it to myself, and it goes to me and comes from me, but it gives you a copy. So that's the email. Just hit reply on that one.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Sorry you're having trouble.
I also, this is Ann.
Welcome, Ann. Go ahead.
Thanks. I have a practical question as well, and that is I didn't speak up at all last week, and I'm wondering how do we acknowledge our presence in each class. Are you taking role or doing anything like that?
I have the teleseminar conference line gives me a record of everyone that attends, so you don't have to. So, if you'll just indicate any questions you have or comments you have or any kind of engagement that way, that's fine. But you don't have to check in to be checked in.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Other things that you'd like to talk
again.
About?
This is Karen.
Yeah,
I will have to give you email you my other number because I'm using my landline, not my cell, during these. So you might
fine. See
a different number.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, thanks. Questions or comments or things you'd like us to talk about that relates to either the exercises that you did for this time or from our discussion last time? As you think about... this is who?
This is Catherine. You mentioned exercises. Is that the ones that are in the back that you're referring to?
When you downloaded and printed the outline, there are some work pages and exercises that are within that outline, that document. So yes,
okay.
I do have some sample exercises and work pages for each of the seminars.
Okay. Thank you.
Those are from the New Life Story Wellness Coaches Training and the New Money Story Mentoring, the license, especially certification training I do. It just gives you some exercises that are relevant to these topics that hopefully will help you catalyze some process of thinking and reflecting on these aspects yourself, and you can see if any of them would be beneficial to use with clients.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Yes, who else?
This was Karen again. What I was trying to email you, and I think we're going to cover this tonight, I work with prisoners, and they have felonies. Some are violent felonies, and some are not so violent felonies. And my question was, how could I work with them in a sense that they can move forward? But I see tonight we're going to talk about change of mind, so perhaps it'll be answered tonight.
The most practical and powerful success strategy, whether you're working with CEOs or prisoners, is how to regulate states of mind.
Okay.
And regulating states of mind is so powerful because our state of mind determines the meaning we attach to something, and the meaning we attach to something determines our behavior. So, and as we talked last time, that really determines so much of how we proceed, how much we can stick to a plan that we have, assuming that we have a plan. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that today and specifically about the how-to. And this is specifically going to be about addressing change with your clients, change that lasts, and change that can be powerful. And this is, I believe, a very important aspect of working with clients, because this is a common aspect of whatever you do with clients. They deal with change. They deal with transition. So this is about how to engage their minds and brains and behavior all in the same way to help them address that, to make changes that last.
Okay, thank you.
Absolutely. Other questions or thoughts or things you'd like to mention before we get into the material? Okay, well, I'm going to save some time then at the end for us to have a discussion, so jot down any questions you have. I'm going to put us on lecture mode just the next bit of time. So in discussing how to change mind, brain, and behavior, a fundamental question: why do we resist change, even changing a story that doesn't work? What keeps people from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? Why will someone repeat behavior that doesn't work, often do it harder, and expect a different result? Kind of like somebody who doesn't understand English and you talk louder English as if that's going to help. Even when it leads to lower energy, debt, plateaued careers, or disappointing relationships. Nassim Taleb asks in his book, The Black Swan, what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. So part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's secure and predictable. A comfort zone can be limiting or uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's the default model. We repeat because we know how it's going to turn out, and that creates the illusion of effectiveness. A new story, on the other hand, generates uncertainty, trepidation. The easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to go back to the familiar, to the old story. People fail to change because they don't feel safe changing. Changing means leaving their home base of reality, their internal map that's synonymous with identity, we tend to return to our default mode. Let's do a brief exercise. If you have a headset, great, but if you are listening on the phone, if you can tuck it between your chin and your shoulder so that both of your hands are free, put your palms together in front of your face and interlock your fingers firmly. Notice which thumb is on top. Now, keep your fingers exactly the same, firmly clasped, but changed so that your other thumb is on top. How does that feel? Kind of awkward, kind of goofy. Now, move so that your original thumb is back on top. Kind of a relief. That's why people don't change or succeed remarkably or derail when they do. They return to their comfort zone. Now, up the ante. Add significant success or significant stress, such as major transition, really out of a comfort zone. We'll talk more about comfort zones and how to program change in just a bit. There's always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. Now, the other part of that answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. The hypnotist Milton Erickson told a story from his childhood in which whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so that he would create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally created a circuitous path, zigzags and indirect turns, and he noticed that every person who followed him followed the same path. Until the end of the day, it was well-worn despite its really circuitous route. No one started a new, more direct route. No matter subsequently how many twists and turns he created, each person in turn always followed the path of least. They followed the path that he created. Nobody created a new path. That's how neural pathways are laid down in the brain, by early experiences, and then repeated until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous and require way more work. To think creatively, new neural pathways need to be developed outside the cycle of experience. Stimulation for new insight is a circumstance in which the brain can't predict what will happen next. The catalyst for insight is a novel stimulus, new information, or a new context, exactly what we do as mentor coaches. Now, we're going to talk about this juncture in particular, when your mind and brain both react to leaving the familiar to engage new behavior. The uncertainty of this newness can be read as evidence not to proceed, as intuition of a wrong choice, or as a signpost of change and progress. This is where we have to help our clients understand their experience and create a new model to evolve with the changes they make, to not read this uncertainty and trepidation as evidence of a wrong choice, like anxiety meant in an old model, dangers ahead, better head for cover, or their intuition telling them this is not right. My gut's telling me this is not the right choice. Their intuition is very valid, but this is a misread of intuition. Discomfort and uncertainty began any significant journey. Our brains even have an error detection mechanism. It's located really close to the emotional center that says, this isn't normal when something's new. Same for change, same for transitions. We're going to talk in just a bit about how to use this mechanism as part of a powerful internal navigation system. We struggle to embrace change. I mentioned that many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to how the mind and the brain work. Neuroscience, quantum physics, strategic coaching have a lot to teach us about change and resistance to change. I want to discuss in this session what I think is the most important variable to determine success for clients, regulating states of mind, as I mentioned, from CEOs to prisoners, never more important than at a time of change and transition. So let's first look at understanding what a state of mind is. A state of mind is a mind-body state, like a specific software program, that determines how we perceive and then how we process information to respond. A state of mind is a set of particular emotions, memories, mental models, and behavioral patterns. A key element of mentor coaching is helping a client become aware of various states of mind with particular focus on which state works best for what purpose. Clients may move from a state where they feel stuck or myopic to possibilities to a state where the scope and range of thinking and possibilities is much broader. Let me give you a very simple example of what I mean by states of mind. If you take a rat, put it in a maze, you can teach it to get to the cheese, and it can go again and again. But if you before you teach the rat to get to the cheese, you inject it with just a little bit of amphetamine and then teach it to get to the cheese, it can go again and again. But now if you remove the amphetamine, the rat can get to the cheese. It can have in a part of its brain the information about how to get to the cheese, but it can't access it. So it can literally, in that maze, die of starvation. Now, if you re-inject the amphetamine, it can immediately go to the cheese. State-specific learning, state-specific memory. Now, this is an example of how two distinct states of mind don't overlap at all. They're distinct. It's really an example of extreme stress, like post-traumatic stress disorder, where an entire event may be remembered in a particular way, or multiple personality disorder, where distinct states can exist without a seamless blending of moving from one state to another as we usually experience in our ordinary lives. A more common example for us may be when we try to think of somebody's name and can't. We know it's on the tip of your tongue, but you just can't recall it. Then later, in a more relaxed state of mind, the name comes easily. It's a change of state of mind. You have access to the information within that state. A state of mind is a mind-body state, like a specific program, software program, that determines how we perceive and process information, how we respond. It's a whole set of experiences, memories, that are each distinct to that state. Each of us has a range of states with some awareness of what state works best for what endeavor, even perhaps of how to enter and exit various states. It's important to know what state to enter, for example, for a creative endeavor, what state to enter for conceptual planning, what state of attention and concentration works best for everything from the alertness of business endeavors to relaxation for sleep. For example, a creative state of mind to write is distinct and different from a state that you enter for editing, so you don't want to go back and forth and change states. You want to carve out time for each. So here's a mentoring application. It's important for the mentor coach to enter into and hold the mind-body state of the client to understand the subjective experience as well as the story communicated by the client. Developmentally, the right brain communicates emotionally before the verbal linguistic abilities of the left brain mature. Most of the interactions in a relationship are outside conscious awareness in a right brain to right brain communication of emotional states of coach and client. Intuitive blinks. I would recommend the book Blink by Malcolm Gladwell. It's a book. He's a great writer. It's a book about how to understand and how to use intuition. So the mentor must remain open to receiving communication from the client's right brain to become attuned to the state of mind of the client. This precedes synthesizing and planning. So once we're tuned into the client, we can receive and resonate with communication in all forms, not just verbal. Together, we can then explore experiences, possibilities, brainstorm, and plan. This resonance can also creatively transform the experience into new ideas, co-creations, beyond where either might go alone. So we need to allow this right brain, this emotional engagement with the client, to take in emotional communication, to hold unexplained experiences, feelings, and ideas until a recognizable pattern emerges. And through the process of change and transition, a lot will be unexplained and without closure for a while. This requires deep listening and attention simultaneously at multiple levels. It's a way of thinking and a way of experiencing combined. It art and science of mentor coaching. So let's look very practically now how to regulate states of mind. The most important thing, I believe, again, that we can do to achieve success is to manage our emotions and regulate our states of mind. A quiz. What do these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Kurt Cobain. They never learned the critical success strategy of managing their states of mind. This list could go on and on, as you know. Using drugs, alcohol, or some other addictive substance or process to regulate a state of mind and manage emotion leads to significant compromise. Your state of mind, the particular software program you use, determines the meaning you attach to a stimulus. That's really fundamental in terms of how our mind works. Your state of mind determines the meaning you attach to something. The meaning you attach then determines your behavior. Think about how when you're in a very relaxed state, you maybe hear something outside, the cat's jumped up on the fence, or probably you don't even notice it. But if you're in a kind of an anxious, vigilant state, you're by yourself, you hear a little bit of noise, and immediately you attach meaning to it and become a little bit frightened and want to find out what's going on. Same noise, different state of mind. The state of mind determines the meaning we attach, and the meaning determines the behavior. So by changing the state of mind, we determine the behavior. Now, there are two primary ways to regulate your state of mind: physiology and focus. Physiology is how you use your body, your biochemistry, to change your state of mind. Easy examples: relaxation, deep breathing, meditation. Second is focus, what and how you focus on. Remember from quantum physics in the brain, you get what you focus on, not what you want. Focus aligns your energy field. What you focus on, what you pay attention to, determines your state of mind. Your state of mind determines the meaning you attach to something. And again, the meaning you attach will determine your behavior. So your power is what you focus on. Now, think about how we always ask ourselves questions. When you get up in the morning, you ask yourself questions before you're even consciously aware of being awake. You ask yourself, what's going to happen today? What do I plan? What could go wrong today? What am I looking forward to? The questions we always ask are two: what does this mean and what should I do? So if you have an habitual feeling you don't like, it can come from a repeated focus and questions. Why does this always happen to me? The presupposition is that you're in a passive position and ineffective. Why am I overweight? The focus is on overweight. The quality of your life comes down to the quality of the questions you ask daily. Change the questions. Ask a better question. Now, this is an application. I've done this with a couple of clients. I became aware of this when I was a guest speaker at Vistage, and a couple of the CEOs had some really traumatic events in their companies that were preoccupying them and their whole management team, and gravitated down to various people in the organization. And what I had them do was, when they went to bed at night, to ask themselves three empowering questions. Questions that would give them a positive focus and an empowering position. Put them by their bedside table, and when they woke up in the morning, as they turned on their bedside lamp, even before they totally woke up, to grab those questions and answer them. Because we're always asking ourselves questions, and they were asking questions like, what could go wrong today? Oh man, how am I going to be pummeled at work today with these happenings? So by asking pre-planned, empowering questions, they established their state of mind as they woke up, and that state of mind permeated the day and changed their day. Try that and see if it works. It sounds too simple, but whatever question we ask, whatever we first think about in the morning, determines a state of mind, and that often lasts into the day. And then a state of mind has a way of determining what we focus on and how we gather data, so it can perpetuate itself. So ask a better question. If you immediately begin by asking what can go wrong today, you've already begun a scenario that establishes a state of mind. So ask a better question. What will I create today that can be more powerful than I ever dreamed of? And have fun doing it. Your brain follows your focus, whether that's positive or negative. Ask questions habitually that empower you. Instead of, why am I overweight, to what can I start to do today for better nutrition and physical shape? Asking effective questions determines your state of mind. This is your power of focus. The best mentors, leaders, and teachers are the ones who ask the best questions to get us to use our resources. People thought Goliath was too big to hit. David asked a really simple question. If he's that big, how could I miss? Starbucks founder Howard Schultz didn't ask if people want to buy a cup of coffee or a latte, but do you want a sense of community, a third place between home and work? And he asked that as he opened his first Starbucks. Listen to how Steve Jobs convinced former Pepsi president John Sculley to become CEO at Apple, ushering in a whole new realm of possibility there. They were on a balcony overlooking Central Park in New York City, and Jobs simply asked Sculley, do you want to sell sugared water all your life, or do you want to change the world? So here's an exercise. Write down three questions that put you in a peak state. Each morning, answer these three empowering questions and feel the answer. And remember, you're already asking questions. This just changed the focus to consistently and consciously engineer the questions that empower you. Now, let's talk about using mantras. And remember I sent you the neuroconditioning work chart after the first seminar. This is the third column on the chart, how to get centered and grounded. And that can be most effective by creating a mantra. And you can do a mantra within a few seconds. Let me tell you a story. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Robert Reed, arrived, his team ranked 217th in free throw percentage out of 217 teams in their division nationwide. During practice, Reed had his players develop a mantra before each free shot. And the mantra was a 3 or 4 word phrase coupled with a deep breath for relaxation. And think about it. This is the focus and the physiology. The focus is the phrase. The physiology is the deep breath. He gave the example of the phrase relaxed and smooth when stepping up to the free throw line, but emphasized that each player determined his own mantra. And had each player cue this process by a couple of dribbles while they were saying this phrase and while they were taking a deep breath in for relaxation and breathing out any tension. Additionally, he simulated game conditions by abruptly stopping a player in practice, getting to shoot 2 free throws. And this is how it works in a game. You don't get to line up and shoot 30 free throws and count your best one. You stop suddenly, usually when you're on tilt from getting fouled, and shoot free throws. And then there's the whole crowd stimulation, away in one direction and home in another direction. So he simulated the mindset of pressure in a game situation by suddenly stopping, and then if the player made a shot, he got to take a breather, but if he missed, he had to sprint around the court 4 times. In 2 years, the team was ranked number 1 in their division nationwide. So again, these are the 3 parts to a mantra. A cue, 2 dribbles or a personal gesture, a phrase, relaxed and powerful, and a deep breath. Breathe in relaxation, breathe out tension. This is the mantra that I use before I do like a keynote presentation, and since I don't usually carry a basketball with me, I do, since you asked, my index finger and thumb together on both hands, making 2 little circles, and then touch them together in the middle, making a little infinity sign while I'm saying relaxed and powerful and doing a deep breath in and a deep breath out. So this takes 2 or 3 minutes, and I'm good to go. Mantras can be used in various situations to regulate states of mind, especially for emotional triggers that can instantly change a state of mind. Some of my clients who are pro athletes and actors have used it to get grounded and centered for their performance. pro athletes are very conscious of managing states. A tennis player, a basketball player can anchor and set in a state by bouncing a ball a couple of times before serving or shooting. So mantras can both calm as well as keep you from overthinking in a high-pressure situation. Now, let's talk about neural conditioning. And remember that four-column chart was the neural conditioning work page. What we associate to a stimulus is what determines our behavior. To change your behavior, change your neural association. In other words, thinking positively is not enough. You can think positively for a moment, but then you go back to what has already been established in your brain and the neural networks and connections. It would be the same effect as trying to change a software program by booting it up and talking positively to your computer. The stimulus response is there in your brain, even if you don't believe, or even if you don't know it's there. It's linked. Winston tastes good. What's your association? For 80% of people, it's like a cigarette should. Even if you don't smoke, even if you have a strong belief linking smoking and cancer, even if it's been 30 years since you last heard that jingle, what you link inside your head, the meaning you give, determines your behavior. You can change your behavior when you change the meaning. You can reprogram your associations and rewire your brain. Reprogramming, neuroassociative conditioning, is a process, not an event. You can't work out one time and be healthy for life. A neural association gets linked or anchored by the coupling of strong emotion to whatever's happening around you at the time. This creates a link. Anchors happen when you're in a highly emotional state. Now, there are two forces behind all behavior: the need to avoid pain, the desire to gain pleasure. To understand in yourself and in your clients the motivating forces of pain and pleasure, the need to avoid pain is biological. The brain fights against change to avoid pain on a biological basis. Trying to create success by creating more pain usually doesn't work as well. Rarely works, actually. In any moment, the pleasure of eating may feel greater than the pain of overweight. The pleasure of the cheesecake may feel much more enjoyable than the pain of the idea of getting fat, especially if it has strawberry topping. Overweight is an abstract idea, not at the same level of sensory reality as an immediate pleasure. So what do you do? Spending money in this moment, another example, seems like a greater pleasure than the later gain of money by saving, or the later pain of avoiding debt financially and emotionally. To change your behavior, you have to change what you link to pleasure and what you link to pain. This is where you come in as a coach. The need to avoid pain is usually greater than the need for pleasure. This drives a lot of human behavior. To influence someone, find out what they're already influenced by, what they link pain and pleasure to. Think about it this way, as a practical application. If you're not doing something that you want or need to do or planned to do, if you're putting it off, procrastinating it, don't understand why because you know you need to do it, then you link more pain with doing it than not doing it. Let's take an example that obviously doesn't make any sense. If you don't have enough money or money that you want, and your goal is to generate more income and to create wealth, and you have a plan, but somehow you're not doing it. Somewhere in your unconscious mind, you link greater pain to having it than not having it, no matter how much sense it doesn't make. With a lack of abundance financially, unconsciously, you may think that money equals pain. For example, all this effort it would take, I think I'm just as comfortable where I am, or I'd have to take advantage of people, or people will judge me and I'll be ostracized, or I'll be alone and lonely all the top. And, you know, I don't really think I have what it takes. I don't know what to do. If you're sabotaging success in any area of your life, look at the approach, wanting pleasure, and the avoidance, having fear. The usual focus is, what will be the pain if I do this? The need for focus, what will be the pain if you don't follow through? What will be the cost and the pain if you don't do it? We are defined by the stories we tell ourselves. Is your story empowering you or causing you to fall short? Is your story a limiting story in any area of your life? Which one is true? The one you pick will be the one you believe and live. Most people get stuck because of the story they tell themselves, the one that came from 10 years ago, or the one they want to believe but can't quite inhabit. Your story contains the patterns that shape your behavior. Now, think about it this way. What's the biggest addiction we have? The thing almost impossible to give up or to abstain from. The pattern sequence that gives us an effective focus and always allows us to escape our own fear. The biggest addiction we have is our problems. We always come back to the problems. That's the reason I couldn't get there. That's the reason I'm not making more money. For any situation, there are three components: state, story, and strategy. Most people in coaching get it wrong. Most people in coaching begin to work with a client for the strategy, with the strategy to change their story. The reason they get it wrong is state always has to come first. Remember, state determines the meaning that we attach, and the meaning determines the behavior. State management is the most important aspect to choose the mindset that matches the successful outcome. So always, state comes first. Strategy is to move beliefs and behavior to a plan for successful performance. Now, most people start with strategy, but strategy is an evolved part of the process. Reevaluation of your approach, your state of mind, is a key element. State, and then strategy, and then the story. Story is the organizer of what you do, the theme and the storylines of what you're pursuing. For Martin Luther King, his story was, I have a dream. In neural conditioning, state comes first, then behavior. So, in a brief summary then, how do you condition yourself to make changes that last? There are three key principles of neural conditioning to create change and make it last. One, identify what to change. You must get to the point where you feel you must do something, must change something, change it now, and that you can change it. Must, can, and will change it. And to feel that not changing would ultimately be more painful than the immediate pain of the change process. Believe that change will ultimately bring pleasure. Change can be linked with pleasure. So here are a couple of questions to ask for step one. If you don't change your patterns, what will be the consequences? What's the pain associated to a current choice that's now adaptive? What will be the pleasure with changing? Two, interrupt the existing pattern. The most common mistake that people make is trying to add a pattern to the ones already existing. Doesn't work that way. You have to interrupt the existing patterns before you add another pattern. Recognize the cues for the behavior so you can interrupt it immediately. A pattern must be interrupted to change neural conditioning and create a different mindset. Questions to ask for this step. What are the cues or triggers for your automatic pattern? Remember, that's column one in the neural conditioning chart. Secondly, think of ways to interrupt the pattern once you've defined it. And thirdly, create a new association that empowers you. Think of all the things you gain and the pleasure you'll have from the change. Condition a new empowering association to the same cue. That's the third column and the fourth column. The centering and the cue for the centering and mantra, and then the fourth column, the ideal response. For example, if you're phobic about something, link feeling strong and powerful with that previous phobic stimulus. When you feel and behave differently, the problem dissolves by creating a new story. Questions to ask for step three. What's the new association to the familiar cue or trigger? what's the change you want to bring about? And then think of all the things you gain and all the pleasure you'll have with the change. Viktor Frankl wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning about his experiences in a Nazi concentration camp during World War II. He was a Jewish psychiatrist in a concentration camp where death was certain. Instead of just giving up and accepting his inevitable fate of death, he observed that 1 out of 25 of his fellow prisoners managed to survive. He set about studying the characteristics of those who survived. He found that it was what the survivors associated to, their neural conditioning, what they associated to, that made the difference for them to survive. 24 out of every 25 focused on the instant death that was inevitable for them. The people who survived developed a reason to survive, to create a meaning for their suffering rather than accepting their fate and wondering why God was allowing them to die. For example, they constructed a reason for surviving so that they could tell their story to their children to make certain that this kind of suffering would never happen again. It changed the meaning of their suffering to something that would make a difference, to substitute an ultimate pleasure, a purpose to transcend the immediate pain of their suffering. They were able to make it through and had a will to live that helped pull them through the toughest of times. So one thing I want to cover before we wrap up, mindset mapping for growth. Our minds constantly monitor and interpret to give us a running account of what's happening, what it means, and what to do. This is how we stay on track or how we get off track or stuck. Mindsets frame the ongoing account of how we interpret, how we process, what we do. Mindsets are powerful beliefs of the stories about ourselves. Researchers at Norwegian University of Science and Technology recently discovered that the brain creates multiple independent maps while finding its way in the physical world. The human brain operates like a Google map. Rather than one big map, the brain makes a whole series of maps to operate and boots up one, whatever the cue is for the present. When a new situation arises, a new map's booted up. This explains how we have different contexts or frames for different situations. Globally, this means that we have different states of mind or mindsets. These mindsets or maps are stored in the hippocampus, the brain's memory focal point. A mindset is its own world, its own software program, complete and internally consistent. That's why we have to be sure it's the right mindset. When you're in downtown Dallas, you don't want a map of downtown Houston. No matter what you do, it wouldn't work. You want an accurate mindset and map. The mindset comes first. The state of mind determines the meaning you attach to a cue or stimulus. To change your behavior, change the meaning you attach. State always comes first, then strategy and story. So let's look for a moment at an application of that. This is something you're going to hear with so many of your clients. Fixed versus growth mindsets. A simple example of two different mindsets. Growth mindset versus fixed mindset. This is huge in navigating change and transition and coaching it. The view you adopt can significantly affect the way you live your life. So let's consider both. Growth mindset. A growth mindset is based on a belief in change. You believe you can enhance and develop yourself. You become open to accurate information about talents and ability. You use it to adjust and grow. Howard Gardner, in his book Extraordinary Minds, concluded that exceptional individuals with growth mindsets have a special talent for identifying their own strengths and weaknesses. And remember, this is exactly what we coach toward with a client. The growth mindset of learning is based on a belief that basic qualities are cultivated, developed, and evolved through life. The fundamental assumption is that everyone can change and grow through experience and application. You can even change how intelligent you are. This is all what we coach toward. Now, consider what we're coaching when we look at fixed mindset. Those with a fixed mindset try to make sure they succeed. A consuming goal is to prove themselves in the classroom, in a career, in a relationship. The fixed repeated question may be, will I succeed or fail? Will I look smart or dumb? Will I be rejected or accepted? Will I be a loser or winner? Yet with a fixed mindset, no amount of confirmation can dislodge the hypothesis of mediocrity or the need for proof. A fixed mindset makes you preoccupied with how you'll be judged versus a growth mindset focusing on improvement. So here are some of the characteristics of a fixed mindset. And remember, every one of these constitutes, in my view, a coachable moment. Intelligence is something basic and essentially unchangeable. You learn things, but you can't change how intelligent you are. You have fixed traits, so success is about proving that you're talented or smart. Problems indicate character flaws. Attempts to repair self-esteem include assigning blame or making excuses. And you can't learn from mistakes as long as you deny them or externalize them. So, beliefs are often not conscious, yet you pay attention to them and you hear them, and then you can change them. As coaches and mentors, we can nudge someone toward a growth mindset. What can you learn from this? How can you improve? Here's an illustration of the impact of belief and mindset. In a Yale longitudinal study of senior citizens, those who saw aging as negative and compromised actually physically deteriorated more over a 3-year period. For example, there was a significant drop in their hearing test, the score of the hearing test that would equivalent to 8 years of normal aging in a 3-year period. Negative feelings about old age can make someone physically age more quickly in areas of hearing, memory, even cardiovascular status. It can reduce the life expectancy by an average, in this longitudinal study, of 7.5 years just based on the mindset. So, to help clients change behavior, mind, and brain, begin where the client is. Help them learn about what they already know. Highlight positive attributes, existing neuronal networks like natural talents, behaviors, and patterns to encourage their practice. Don't focus on mistakes. Focus will enhance neuronal etching, so it should be on useful habits. Correct mistaken couplings. Understand and build on existing networks. Let sleeping dogs and old unuseful networks lay. The brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel connections. The client has to recognize and take ownership of his or her experiences first. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Give attention to a new experience or new way of doing things consistently and repetitively. And finally, encourage the clients to develop their own metaphors and connections. Stories, analogies, and metaphors create maps. So here's a summary of the principles of successful mentor coaching. Mentor coaches focus on solutions rather than understanding why, on co-creating options rather than getting advice or dictates. Since old patterns are hardwired, it takes consistency of focus on new experiences to change this wiring. The first requirement is recognizing a story and claiming ownership of the story in order to understand, assess, and change. Peter Drucker said, the most pressing task is to teach people how to learn. So let's review. Let's just bullet some of the important elements for mentoring successful change. Concentrate on new behaviors rather than problems in order to create new brain pathways. Identifying the problems won't solve them. Co-create new ways of thinking to stimulate brain circuits with an eye on the prize to lay new mental maps. Regulate your state of mind and manage emotions to promote brain power. New insights and adaptations occur through balanced learning, left brain plus right brain. Intellectual and emotional. Facilitate insight rather than give advice. People can usually also discriminate between inquiries that prompt insight and attempts at persuasion disguised as questions. Focus on successes rather than obstacles or non-performance. The power is in the focus. Emphasize positive, adaptive behavior and progress. Discourage attention to negative behavior. Facilitate new behaviors and guide the development and actualization of new mental maps. Collaboratively conceptualize the mental map, the internal model of the client, in order to facilitate a new level of mastery. In the event of diversion to an old feeling or behavior, redirect ideas and energy flow to the new ideas rather than continue to explore the reasons and the motivation and the causes of the problem. Remember that the power is in the focus and that permanent change comes from the consistency of that focus. Knowledge conveyed passively is inert. Knowledge generated through insight changes the mind and brain. And finally, conceptualize the meta map with the client in order to master and internalize the process. This helps create the outline to incorporate the new experience as a storyline and part of an evolving identity. Remember that we talked about the most powerful force of the human psyche is for someone to return to their core identity. So unless the model of someone, how they operate, how they see themselves, that parallels the change in behavior is addressed, they'll likely revert back to their core identity. We have a few minutes now for discussion, for questions. I'm interested in what you think and any questions or clarifications that you have about what we've talked about or some additional ideas.
Wow.
I know it's a transition to kind of passively listen to actively engage in discussion, but I'm eager to hear what your thoughts and responses are. Does this all make sense to you, first of all?
Oh,
I guess that's a basic question.
Yeah, lots of sense.
Does it seem practically applicable to you? Can you really grasp what we're talking about enough to think about making it actively useful in practical language with clients? That's what I'm interested in, is the practical application, and does it make sense to you in listening to clients, engaging with them through the relationship about what you do then?
Mm-hmm.
Hi, this is Jennifer.
Jennifer, go ahead, please.
In answer to your question, I would say definitely yes. These are in audio format because it's one of those things that I would really need to listen to this a couple of times to be able to integrate it and process it, because I find that I can't write down everything you're saying, and if I do, I'm not actually actively listening. So I'm so glad they're in audio so that I can go back and hear it for the second time and then maybe be able to take some notes.
And that's why I encourage you to come back with questions. I struggle with that because I know that I'm compressing a lot of material and a lot of information into 45 minutes or so, and I want to give you as much as possible, but I know it also doesn't present itself as a typical seminar, which is really my favorite style of teaching, where there's a lot of interaction and back and forth, because there's just so much information. So it's a trade-off, and I've decided to do more information because I want you to have that, and I've really emphasized wanting it recorded so you can go back and then so that we can have discussion at the beginning and the end. And I realize it's a lot, and I know it's compressed and rich material, and some of it's new and different. Some of it's just looking at things in a different way. So I hope it's a good balance for you and something that you can really take away something practical, because I want to give you as much as possible in these four seminars, because this really in some ways is the tip of the iceberg, but it's enough for a beginning, and I think enough to make some practical changes, and I hope it's useful and relevant for you. But if you have any suggestions, let me know.
I think you're doing it beautifully. I think helpful with that. I did have one question. You mentioned, I wasn't sure if I had missed something, but you mentioned that you had sent something out after the first class regarding mantras.
I sent the one-page neural conditioning work chart.
I got
Where?
That, the roadmap. Is that what you're talking about?
No, I'm talking about. Let me check on that. I thought she sent it out.
I got a map for a new life story, but I didn't get anything else, and I think you referred
okay.
to it a couple of times, so I felt like I maybe missed something.
Okay.
Yes.
Let me send that out then again.
Here.
The
yeah.
neural conditioning work page. I'll send it out to everyone. And
good.
There are a couple of blogs that I have. If you go to my website, MentorPath, and on the far right tab is blogs. And if you go to the blog, I think the second down on the archive blogs is about mantras, and there's a reiteration of some of what I talked about. There may be some other blogs there that are of interest to you. It's about the psychology, the neuroscience, roughly generally relating to money, but it's practical ways of, and you can sign up for the blog, have it delivered to your email. I don't do it, you know, like three times a week. I don't do it real often, but if it's of interest to you, sign up, and it'll be a way we can continue to communicate because, I really enjoy doing blogging, and I write about things that I think would be useful for people to look at. So hopefully some of it might be of interest to you. Other thoughts or other questions?
Yeah, hi. This is Dave. Dave, hi. It's Lee in Washington, and I came in late. I can't imagine how the first half was any more powerful than the second half of what I did here. But I have a question, a couple questions, actually. One is you said something I didn't quite hear, and it was you said the power is in focus and that permanent change comes from, and I missed that last part.
The power is in the focus and permanent change comes from the consistency of that focus. Whenever we focus on something, we align our energy field in our brains. It's the quantum Zeno effect. We align our focus, just like when you stroke a magnet on a nail in one direction, you align the electromagnetic field so you create a magnet. We do the same thing, and when we consistently focus on
something,
we align our brains.
Okay.
That's all right, I'm on mute.
Okay, there was someone else who spoke at the same time as Lee who had a question.
I actually had a second question if they don't
mind. Go ahead if someone...
Yeah, second question is, you've talked a couple of times about balancing the left and right brain activities, and what's a simple way to introduce that when coaching, you know, other than saying we're going to balance the left brain and the right brain? Is there a way to support that as an activity?
Yes. It's basically what we talked about today. The way to create that balance is to get centered and grounded, to regulate state of mind and get centered. That way you have access to all the states of mind and a balance of left and right brain. If someone is a little bit upset emotionally, they're going to be overbalanced in their right brain, and that can seize and hold hostage the left brain. If they have been upset or hurt or have some kind of a cue that they're ruminating or overthinking or obsessing about something, they're going to be overbalanced to their left brain. So the remedy for both, and that's why state is first and most important, is to regulate state of mind. For example, somebody comes and says to a coaching session, says, you know, I've just had a really upsetting event, and I don't think I can work. I'd like to reschedule so that I'll be able to make the best use out of my coaching time. I will ask that person, this occurred maybe a couple of times over 10 years, but it's a principle that's worth reiterating. I will ask, would you like to spend just a moment or two to really get centered and grounded first?
Mm-hmm.
And then when I'll do a brief progressive relaxation exercise with them. And after just a minute or two, they're grounded and centered. And inevitably, they want to work on what caused the upset and how they got derailed. And they have two tools now that they didn't have. One is how to self-regulate, because they can do this themselves. together, and they recognize that regulating state of mind is most important and first, then you can approach something in a much more balanced and logical way when emotions are intact. And you can integrate feelings when you're not overly obsessing or ruminating about something isolated in your left brain. So the process is most important, and state always comes first. So that's a good example of that. I know we're a little bit over. Thank you all very much. If there are additional questions you have, jot them down, and let's pick up here next time. I'll send you that neural conditioning work page. And if there are any questions about it, we can also talk about it next time. Thank you all very much. I appreciate all of your attention and energy. Hope it was helpful. And look forward to picking up next week. Bye now. Have a great rest of the week.
Thank you.
You guys. Thanks.
Bye-bye.